Alexandra Fuller loves everything about Africa, its smell, its sounds, its people. But it wasn't always that way. Steve Paulson spoke with her about her memoir, Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, An African Childhood. Fuller says she grew up in a white family on a farm in what was then called Rhodesia during the Civil War. At the time, she wasn't aware of the hate her parents held for the black Africans around them.
As a child, you can't know what racism is. So the language that they used came into my vocabulary the way, for instance, Inuits are supposed to have 20 different ways of describing snow. My parents must have had 20 different ways to slander black Africans. And they spoke almost as if Africans were not just a different race, but a different species. I think that's very common in a war experience, to dehumanize the enemy to the point that they don't exist as human brothers and sisters. I think you almost need to do that if you're going to point a gun at somebody and pull the trigger. And it was important, I think, for them that my sister and I understood Africans in this way in case we needed to pull a gun on Africans. We were taught, we were handed guns at the age of 6.
So you were very aware of the political violence around you.
I was aware of the violence around me. That it was political didn't occur to me. I was a child. I didn't have any awareness of the politics. In fact, I didn't understand peace. I didn't understand the concept of living in peace. When Mugabe came to power in 1980 and there was independence and the war for liberation was over, another war began between the Shona people, led by Mugabe and his 5th Brigade, against Nkomo's people in Ndebele. And that war went on until 1987, till I was 18. So I had not known peace. That, I think, is one of the big differences between this book and, you know, obviously people have brought up names like Isaac Dennison and Beryl Markham. But they'd written in that rather ridiculous period. I call it the British picnic in Kenya period, you know, where they sort of went out and had cucumber sandwiches and ignored the fact that their gin and tonics and cucumber sandwiches were being had on the backs of an entire continent. I mean, they were oppressing an entire continent to do it. My childhood happened to be through the sort of teapot of that Tea Party cracking.
And it's worth pointing out that for all of the warnings that your parents would give and your teachers at school about, you know, watch out for bombs, watch out for mines, it wasn't just paranoia. You write, for instance, about how a lot of African men would leave their villages and go off and join the guerrilla camps, and you found remnants of those camps on your family's land, which suggests that they were watching you go about your daily affairs.
Oh, all the time. I remember my father dressing up to fight. He fought on the, what I consider the wrong side of the war. He fought to keep Rhodesia white. And he was called up by the Rhodesian government, and the Land Rover would come to the end of the road, and down he would walk. And he had painted himself black, in black stripes. He was in camouflage. And my mother had made a cotton band, camouflage band, go over his watch so that it wouldn't glint in the sun. I remember my father telling me that they weren't allowed to brush their teeth because the smell of that toothpaste was so strong. So, you know, the sense of living really two lives, one secret, hidden, fighting life, and then this other life where you're trying to be normal.
Now, your family also, even though they were quite poor and they were farmers, they did have some hired help, black help.
Well, isn't that the irony? I mean, we would be hungry sometimes, but yes, we had servants.
And how were they treated by your family?
Almost as if they didn't exist. I've described it since then the best way that I can, is that to live in Africa assuming superiority is to live in white noise and not be listening, not paying attention to what's around you. So they were treated very much as tools, I think.
You have a very vivid scene, a horrifying scene, when your parents' cook robs your house, steals your mother's rings, and brutally slashes a woman, and your father and a few friends of his hunt him down. They go out the next morning. And I'm wondering if you could read that passage, because I think it really illustrates some of the racial tensions then.
Dad radios mum from the car. Oscar Papa 28, Oscar Papa 28, this is Oscar Papa 28 mobile. Do you read? Over. Mum runs from her bedroom, but Vanessa and I have heard the Agri-Alert crackle into life too. Tim, Oscar Papa 28 mobile? This is Oscar Papa 28. Are you all right? Over. There's a pause, and then Dad's voice, hissing with static. I got the bastards. We found your rings. Over and out. Mum shouts, Wahoo! And Vanessa and I spontaneously perform our version of a Red Indian war dance around the veranda. Wah, 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 wah. We skip on alternate legs. By the time Dad comes back with July and his companion, both the cook and his accomplice have swelling eyes and lips and hard, bone-like lumps on their faces. Vanessa and Mum and I are standing in the yard. When Mum sees July get out of the car, she runs at him. She's screaming, Kaffir! Murderer! She starts to beat him, but Dad pulls her back. He says, Let the boys deal with him. He nods to the boys. The militia, who have come to arrest July and his companion, turn and look the other way. Dad's boys kick July, and in one soft sound, like a sack of mealy meal hitting concrete, he buckles to his knees, and then they kick him again and again. Then Dad says, That's enough, eh? But they don't stop. Dad says to the militiamen, Better pull them off before they kill the bastard. The militiamen break the boys from the tight scrummage of kicking. They put July and his accomplice in the back of their white pickup. He has been handcuffed and his eyes are almost shut with swelling. As the militia drive off down the road, he makes one last attempt to escape, flinging himself from the moving car and hitting the dirt road. It seems impossible he doesn't burst on impact. Two of the militiamen explode out of the front of the truck, and then dust kicks up and the white truck and the men and July vanish from view for a moment. When the dust clears, they are dragging July behind the truck by a rope. He runs, his legs spinning like an egg whisk, until he is jerked off his feet, and then he is pulled, twisting behind the vehicle, until it reaches the end of the driveway. After that, the militiamen throw him in the back of the truck, and he does not try to jump out again.
Do you remember what your response was when you heard that story?
I was there when July, when that incident occurred.
You saw that beating.
Yeah. There were two occasions that stand out in my mind when I felt that I was neither white nor black, that I could neither belong to this family nor turn my back on Africa, and when I hated myself for being white and for being a part of this family. This was the one occasion when, young as I was, I felt the sense of self-loathing and the burden of my whiteness without even understanding the true heritage, my true horrible inheritance.
How old were you then?
I must have been about 9 when Violet was attacked. The other occasion was after the war, when my mother, very pregnant with her 5th child, took me out to a squatter camp that had been set up on our farm by refugees coming back from Mozambique. And she was furious that they had set up a squatter camp on the river at the top of our farm. And she felt that the farm was ours. And she had put a lot of work into the farm. My father had been out fighting. She'd run the farm single-handedly for so long. And she rode her horse at these people who had set up the squatter camp. And I was on my horse, sort of cowering under the roof of a hut. And the split that I felt was that I didn't want something to happen to Mum or this baby. I was old enough to know that about miscarriages, and I was old enough to want this baby desperately. We had lost 2 children in our family and at that point. But also, I was terrified she was going to hurt the villagers. She was running at women and children with her horse. And I think then I knew that her brilliance and her bravery and the things about her that were wonderful, the flip side of that was this terrible madness. And that was the first time I think I saw that madness. It was as if the last thread to her sanity had snapped and that murder wasn't out of the question.
You've done something, it seems to me, very unusual with this memoir. I mean, you've really told the story from the wrong side of history.
Yes.
From the racist perspective. How did you approach that as a writer?
I tried to write fictionalized versions of this, because it was so hard for me to face up to the truth and face up to, you know, what I have just told you, this great, horrible, ghastly mantle of my heritage.
And you don't sugarcoat it. I mean, you could have softened the way your parents come off. I mean, in many ways, they're very endearing, but not on the question of race.
Right. Well, when I tried to write it as fiction, one's instinct is to sugarcoat. And it was one of those sort of 3 o'clock in the morning things when I sat up in bed and I said to myself, I have to tell the truth. Somebody from the wrong side of the war needs to tell the truth about what it's like growing up within the confines of racism. Now, it's not all black and white. Because my parents were racist, it doesn't mean I loved them any less. And I'm very, very grateful for some of the life lessons they've given me. My mother certainly didn't coddle us. She wasn't a great nurturer, but she was a fantastic teacher. And when I came to the West, I was 18 years old when I left Africa and understandably nervous about launching out into the great world. And she looked at me and she said, Bobo, there's practically nothing anyone can do to you now to hurt you anymore. Off you go. Well, maybe that was a good thing. And it's true, you know, nothing, I really do feel like almost nothing can happen to me that I can't face.
Do you ever think about moving back to
Absolutely.
Africa?
Absolutely. Daily. In fact, we're moving back probably towards the end of this year to Tanzania. Hmm. I think that all of us have magnets in our souls, something close to that maybe. And you know that inexplicable feeling that you have? You haven't met someone before, but you just have this instant attraction, or even have some sort of, might just like them very, very much, but for no good reason. That's your soul magnet for people. And you might love a place for no good reason at all. That's my soul magnet, is for those parts of Africa, Central and Southern Africa. I get off the plane and I open my mouth to drink the air. I don't just breathe it. It's the tastes and smells and sounds of Africa I just long for.
Alexandra Fuller speaking with Steve Paulson about her memoir, Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, An African Childhood.